You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And did you say 2011? Oh, 2005. I was going to say that sounded awful recent. Okay, 2005. Thank you very much. You know, 2005 was the year that David Souter was pilloried, metaphorically anyway, by mostly conservatives, but there were a few of us progressives in there who were kind of upset with him for the Kelo case, Kelo versus New London, Connecticut. Those of you who are Supreme Court wonks know what I'm talking about. Those of you who don't, let me explain. The Fifth Amendment, and where I'm going with this, by the way, this is David Souter's revenge, and it's a good one. And what's happening here is that cities, particularly in this case, in particular, a city in California, Richmond, California, has figured out a way to use this Supreme Court decision to help out homeowners and screw the banksters. Or not screw the banksters. Leave the banksters intact, but not profitable, not as profitable as they would otherwise be. And so let me just, you know, lay out how it works. It's really pretty straightforward. Well, first of all, the Kelo decision. Actually, first of all, the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution says that if, it says that, first of all, the government has the right to seize private property for government purposes, for the purposes of building schools, roads. I mean, it doesn't specify what the purposes are, but in fact, here's what it says. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Okay, that's in the Fifth Amendment. So, in other words, the government has the authority to take private property for public use, but they have to pay whatever the market, you know, just compensation, whatever the market value of their property is. So if they decide they want to build a road or a bridge through where your house is located, they can come to you and say, you are going to sell your house to us. We will have an independent appraiser determine its value, and that's what we will pay you. Or some variation on that theme. Now, historically, this was always just for government purposes. Like, you know, we're going to do this, and we're going to build a military base there. We're going to do this, we're going to build a school there. We're going to take your house and build a school. We're going to take your house and build a superhighway. These are all government functions. Well, in 2005, actually earlier than that, the city of New London, Connecticut, had a part of town that was on the beach, as I recall, or near a waterfront. It was, significantly high-value property that was basically low-income housing. And there was a corporation, a for-profit corporation, that said to the city of New London, Connecticut, seize that property from those slumlords or whoever, you know, or the people who live there. Seize that property, give it to us, or sell it to us at whatever the value of it is, and we will build malls and casinos and high-end housing, and instead of generating $1 million a year in tax revenue, it'll generate $100 million a year in tax revenue. It'll be better for the city. It'll be, you know, quack. More tax revenue, better quality of life, blah-de-blah. What about the poor people who live there? Well, they get to go live someplace where they don't have a view. Rather cynical, but hey, it resonated with the Supreme Court. So the lawsuit that was brought against New London was, you guys don't have the right to take private property and give it to a private for-profit corporation. The government is not going to end up owning this. It's going to be a private for-profit corporation that's going to end up owning this, and the only rationale that you're using is that the government's going to get more taxes and the quality of life in New London as a city is going to be better, and even that's arguable. But the Supreme Court said, no, this is fine, which radically expanded the power of state, federal, and local governments to seize your property for pretty much any purpose that they declare to be in the, using the phrase from the Fifth Amendment, public interest. Now comes the city of Richmond, California. Richmond, California, now you understand how all this works. Richmond, California is looking at all these underwater homes. I mean, this is one of the towns that was really hit badly. During the inflation of the housing bubble, you saw an explosion in property values in California. And Richmond was one of those cities where that explosion happened. And so what they're doing is they're going in and they're saying basically, you know, somebody's got a $200,000 mortgage on a $100,000 house that is now worth $100,000. Now, the bank might have told you it was worth $200,000 back when they loaned you the money in 2006, but ain't no more. So it's worth $100,000. You got a $200,000 mortgage. And this is a danger to the town. People are going to walk away from it. They're going to default. Now, the banksters don't care. They, you know, there's federal backup programs set for banksters. They get to deduct the not only do they get to take it off their taxes, but they also get money from the federal government when they take a hit on a foreclosure. Banks actually make profits on foreclosures. That's why they're pushing so hard to push through foreclosures. So what the town is saying to the bank is, screw that. If somebody's got a $200,000 mortgage on a $100,000 value house, we are going to come to you, the bank, and the homeowner, and offer to buy that house for $100,000 minus the cost of the whole process of figuring it out and evaluating it and determining and appraising and blah, 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 blah. So it's about 20% off the top. So it'll be about $80,000. We'll buy that house from you for $80,000. And you, the bank, you get to write off that $120,000 loss. You don't lose a penny. Federal government will back you up on this. To the homeowner, then, we are going to offer to sell that house back to them, and we're going to work with this company that's taking the 20% off the top to deter, you know, to make all this happen. They're going to get you a mortgage for $80,000 at current rates. So you get a brand new 20 or 30 year mortgage at 3 or 4% interest rate for $80,000 on a house that's worth $100,000. So the homeowner now has already instantly $20,000 in equity in their house. So the homeowner's payments are dropped tremendously so that they can, instead of sending money to the bank every month, they can go into the community, they can buy things at the local stores and thus stimulate the economy, create demand, not just the local economy, but the whole national economy. And this is a really good thing. The homeowner starts building equity as they start paying down that house over the next 20 years. The house is worth more and more and more, so when they retire, they can you know, have a place to live, or they've got equity in it. They can sell the house and live off that or whatever they want. And this is classically how the middle class builds equity. And the banks are, you know, they're made whole. They're fine. Now, as you can imagine, the banking industry is hysterical about this. A couple of towns have tried this in the past. And said, and the banking industry came in with lobbyists and lawyers and lawsuit threats and all kinds of things. Well, Wells Fargo, in fact, with the city of Richmond, just came, you know, just they were just crazy. They said, "We believe this approach will harm mortgage investors." Right. In other words, banksters. It will. They're not going to make as much profit. The housing market. No, it's not going to hurt the housing market at all. And the communities and borrowers that its proponents claim they would be helping. No, sorry, not going to happen. So Richmond, you know, has not backed down so far. And in fact, their city attorney looked into this and came back and said, you know, we can do this. So let me just now say to any housing activist, and by the way, it was Occupy Richmond that was pushing this. This was the Occupy movement that was pushing this. Good on them. Let me say to every city in America, any city officials who are listening, or anybody who's an activist, or anybody who has a house that's underwater, talk to your local city officials about using their Fifth Amendment powers of eminent domain to take your home and then sell it back to you at fair market value. This would work. Banksters won't be happy, but hey, banksters are showing record profit. Last year, banksters made more profit than any time in the history of planet Earth. The history of Western civilization. The banksters can handle it. Trust me.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, pretty straightforward stuff. Richmond, California. This is a Bay Area city near San Francisco. They sent a letter out to 32 banks saying, we're going to do it. Now, meanwhile, okay, my opening rant was about, you know, the Kelo case and what the city of Richmond, California is up to, which I think is just super cool. But in the world of NSA spying, we also got a big revelation today. This is big news. The Guardian, Glenn Greenwald writes for The Guardian, and Glenn Greenwald published in The Guardian today a whole brand new set of presentations done for the NSA, I believe by a private contractor, talking about how, you know, they've been saying, okay, we're gathering all your phone metadata. And so we know, you know, if you called an abortion clinic, we know if you called your local subversive, we know if you called, you know, the strip bar, we know if you called, you know, whatever. And, you know, now we're discovering that police departments are gathering license plate metadata, same deal. Well, this is about a new program called X Key Score. And basically what it is the NSA is also tracking your emails, your searches, and the websites that you're visiting. And not just you, but everyone. And without warrants. And they're gathering these mind-boggling amounts of data together in this huge database, X Key Score, which they had earlier told Congress they were not doing. Now, here's where it gets really weird. Congressman Alan Grayson, congressman with Guts.com, remember him? Congressman Alan Grayson, the guy who, the congressman from Florida who stood up on the floor of the House and said, here's the Republican health care plan. One, don't get sick. Two, if you do get sick, die quick. That guy, Alan Grayson, he was holding hearings. He was going to hold hearings today at the House of Representatives. It's a couple blocks from here, and you know, in the you know, one of the office rooms and one of the hearing rooms in the U.S. Capitol about what the NSA is up to. And Glenn Greenwald was going to testify at those hearings, presumably flying in from South America where he lives, was going to testify at those hearings, presumably about this brand new, I mean, it's not a brand new program, but we just now today learned about it, the X Key Score program, where the NSA is snooping on all of our web activity. So they got our phone calls, they got our web activity now. In a very systematic way, and in the article over at The Guardian details, it's got all these graphics, you know, the PowerPoint presentation of exactly how they do it and how they just plug your IP address or your email address into this giant database and boom, out comes everything you've ever done, basically. Or a variation thereof. And Glenn Greenwald was going to testify about this before Congress today. And here's where it gets even weirder. You know President Obama? He really doesn't like going to the Capitol building. I mean, he's been there, what, twice in 5 years, other than for ceremonial functions? I mean, he just, you know, the whole idea of going to the Capitol building to meet with members of Congress, it's just something he doesn't do. He invites them to come to the White House. And he doesn't even do that all that often, which is one of the things that people on both the left and the right have, I don't want to say criticized, critiqued him for. You know, it's a difference in style. All right, Lyndon Johnson knew all those people. He'd been in Congress for half his life. He'd hang out with them. Bill Clinton was very gregarious. He likes hanging around with people. I think, personally, that President Obama is just, I think he's an introvert, frankly, who's learned how to pretend that he's an extrovert. And he would just as soon not deal with all this human drama. A little bit of Mr. Spock in there. And just deal with the details and the facts. But today, something happened. Without warning, without setting it up, without making appointments, nothing. The president decided that he's going to go over to Congress and meet with the Democrats. Hey, Democrats, would you get together with me? Now, when the leader of your party and the president of the United States says, would you please meet with me in your house, you pretty much have no choice but to say, sure. Which means that, you know, Glenn Greenwald, I mean, he may be in the waiting area of Dulles Airport. I don't know if he's gone through customs yet or not, but Glenn Greenwald will not be testifying today. Alan Grayson had to postpone the hearing to September which is like at least 5 weeks from now, maybe slash probably longer, when, of course, this news will no longer be news, there won't be cameras, there won't be any interest, nobody is going to cover it, it'll be a dead event. And so, as my old friend Lamar Waldron used to say, coincidence or conspiracy? I think we can figure out what's going on here. This is not rocket science. I mean, this is where I find it so fascinating that the president and the kind of John McCain normal Republican faction, if anybody could call John McCain normal, but oddly enough, John McCain, the John McCain, Lindsey Graham, hard right, crazy moderates in the Senate compared to Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. The president, the so-called moderate Republicans, and the so-called moderate Democrats, you know, the kind of Chuck Schumer category, you know, the mainstream Dianne Feinstein group of Democrats, are all saying, this NSA stuff, there's no droids in this car. Whereas the liberals, the genuine progressives in the House, and the genuine right, hardcore right-wingers, the Tea Partiers in the House, just voted so close that if only 7 members of Congress had changed their votes, they would have defunded the NSA's phone tapping program. Now they've got another one to look at.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But my guess is that the White House and the establishment have learned from the experience of the phone tap program, and this one is not going to get anywhere near the publicity response. Other news out of California. This is just like, this is a great news day, I got to tell you. It's fascinating. I mean, it's not great news that the NSA is spying on everything you do on the Internet, but it is, I think, great news that we're starting to learn about it. San Francisco is learning from North Dakota. North Dakota has a state-owned bank. Banking is a very profitable business. And so the profits from that bank, instead of North Dakota banking with Wells Fargo, they bank with themselves. And the profits from that go to reduce taxes and provide services to people in North Dakota, which has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the state, in the United States, as a consequence of this. Well, the city of San Francisco is looking at doing this. Deputy City Attorney Thomas J. Owen just wrote an opinion that the city can do it. And because it's a charter city, there are 112 of these cities in California, including San Francisco. As San Francisco moves between 10 and 12 billion through 133 accounts and roughly 5 million transactions every year, writes Ellen Brown over at the Huffington Post about this. So, I mean, this would be really cool. And, you know, if the banksters take a hit, if the banksters can't deal with it from, you know, turning housing values into what they actually are, then goodbye, banksters. We could do with fewer big banksters. So I think this is all, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of good news here. 25 minutes before the hour, Mike in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's creepy how well you guys can zero in on me with the, given the tone of the NSA, but
what do you mean?
So I called you about
that we know that you're
in
McHenry.
Your screener knew exactly my name and exactly where I was from.
Oh, that's because you've called before.
I know. I'm just making a joke, being a little sardonic.
Okay.
Anyway, in terms of the banks and the eminent domain, although I support this on the surface, and I'm with you. Somebody's got to do something to step in to stop this flood. However, you being a sage student of American history, if we travel back to the roots of the nation and we dispel some of these myths about the Civil War and about the American Revolution, and we break it down to the founders instilling capitalism in the United States, because many historians, including Howard Zinn, would agree with the late Howard Zinn, I should say, would agree with that assumption, that the Civil War was more or less an attempt to shed the last of the lord and serf system in the United States. With that being said, municipalities and states using eminent domain to act sort of as a firewall between the banksters and the citizens. It carries a very dangerous cost. And I will use Shays Rebellion as an example. When Shays Rebellion happened, and I know you know the meaning of
it. Shays Rebellion was 200 plus years ago.
It was, Tom. But Shays Rebellion was based in Massachusetts farmers. Shays himself, rising up, and they were Revolutionary War veterans who rose up against the banks, who were supported by the Continental Congress, who were foreclosing upon their land.
Mm-hmm.
So the response to Shays Rebellion was what? It was a constitutional convention, and it was the ominous federal government that we have today that has transgressed from the war on drugs.
So, Mike, is your solution that we undo our federal government and go back to the Articles of Confederation?
No.
So what are you suggesting we should do?
The exact opposite, Tom. Going back to the Articles of Confederation is almost what this is, because it allows municipalities and it allows states to start crafting their own monetary policy. What this has not worked in the ancient Greek city-states, it did not work with the anarchists in the Italian city-states, and it will not work in the United States. And what's concerning about it is this, because when localities, municipalities, or states start to create their own monetary policy, and I'm not saying it's not a noble effort. And I'm not
this is not a monetary policy, Mike. They're not defining the amount of currency in circulation. They're not defining the amount. I mean, arguably, they are by writing down debts. You're reducing the amount of money in circulation in general in the whole nation. But it's going to be so small compared to the hundreds of trillions of dollars, literally of dollars, that are circulating worldwide. That it's irrelevant. I mean, this is not monetary policy.
I'm with you on this, and I'm with you on pretty much everything. The danger here that makes me uneasy is that we are autonomously starting to come up with solutions to a much larger problem in the United States.
Well, Congress is not regulating the banksters.
They are not.
This is an absolute failure of Congress, and so cities are stepping up to the plate. There's nothing unconstitutional about that.
Oh, no, I'm not saying it's unconstitutional. I'm not taking that right wing.
There's nothing, I don't think there's anything even dangerous about this. The biggest danger is that, if thousands of cities or hundreds of cities across the United States were to start doing this and do it really aggressively with 60, 70, 80% of the underwater mortgages in their towns, then the banks might be forced to reduce their asset ratio on their balance sheets to the point where they would be insolvent. Some of the very large banks who engage in a lot of risky loans, which is fine with me.
They may be, but my education and my better senses tell me that the federal government will react in a way to protect the banks, as they always have. They are not all of a sudden going to become. They're not all of a sudden going to acquiesce.
I don't think so. I think that, Obama was unable to or maybe unwilling to fight the banks with regard to the average person. Bush certainly didn't. I mean, Bush twice, two TARPs, bailed out the banks and rather than the homeowners who were screwed. And this was all over mortgages. And so now something's being done. I have a feeling he'll sit on the sidelines and watch. But, Mike, I've got to move along. Thank you for the call. Steve in Longview, Washington. Hey, Steve, license plate tracking?
I got a general question, Tom, on all this. How are they tracking corporations along with the emails and the license plates, cell phones? I'm Bill Gates. I have 20 cars. I want to create a crime. How are they tracking me? Is it all aimed at the poor?
No, it's aimed at everybody. And I don't know that there's any kind of specific corporate tracking. Probably is, actually. I mean, you've got foreign governments that are hacking into our corporate computing systems, looking for secrets and looking for information, hacking into the U.S. patent office, looking to get patent information before it's filed, things like that. So maybe. But I think that this is everybody, and that's the creepy part of it. Steve, thanks for the call. Marcia in Angier, North Carolina. Hey, Marcia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. So, listen, I've been listening to you, I think it's about a year now. I don't think I've missed a day. And I've been listening. You've brought so much to my attention from the lady who called yesterday about Wisconsin, about them stepping up on them being allowed to protest inside the state house, and they're starting to arrest them.
Yep.
You know, here in North Carolina, that's the reason that the Moral Monday folks were getting arrested, because we're not allowed to speak, you know.
Yes. And just, by the way, just as an FYI for you and for our viewers and listeners, in the third hour of our program today, we're going to kick off that third hour about, you know, an hour and a half from now, with Reverend William Barber, who is the founder of Moral Mondays in North Carolina. He's going to be on the show today.
It was awesome Monday. I think it was the last one, if I'm not mistaken, and all the teachers came out. But, I mean, you bring so many issues. I mean, and then you had that gentleman on that was right-wing who was saying that we are voting Democratic because we want Medicaid, and that those promises to us are why we continue to vote that way, and that he actually believes stuff like that. And what's more is, you know, he has the First Amendment right to go and talk to other people and tell other people that stuff, and they believe it. And one of your solutions is, you often say, is to go to PD America, and I like that organization. I don't have anything against them. But in terms of Democratic voting, I just have to say it again and again. These, with this NAFTA and this SHAFTA and all these issues with the civil rights thing, the corporations have everything. It's like we're at where the buffalo are being pushed off the ledge to kill the Indians. I mean, they are trying to kill us. And, you know, one day we're saying, okay, Obama, we like this about you, but we don't like that about you. Or Dianne Feinstein, she was great. She was saying all this stuff about gun rights. Let's take care of that. And then the next day, oh, I support NSA spying on you. Right. I mean, they don't have their minds straight. And to continue to support the Democrats is just crazy. And I wish.
Well, that's why I suggest PD America rather than the Democratic Party. PD America has nothing to do with the Democratic Party. It's a group of independent people who typically vote for Democrats, but only if they're progressive Democrats. And they're trying to get more progressive, genuine progressives in office, targeting on those races, and they're trying to push the more mainstream Democrats in a more progressive direction, and I think that they've been accomplishing that, by the way.
I follow you on that, but yeah. If you need corporate donations, you cannot be...
Well, PD America doesn't take corporate donations. Yeah, but I'm with you on that, too. Marcia, there's lots of great organizations out there. I've got, I got no dog in this fight. PD America is a great one, but there are just a lot of really great organizations. And my main point is just get involved. Find a local organization, one of the Occupy movements, Color of Change, whatever it may be. There's a lot of great organizations. Get involved. Thank you, Marcia.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Marcia is so right, though. That is the key point. And you can't just say, oh, it's the party, it's fine. No, no. You've got to get at it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tom in Tallahassee, Florida. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I caught a part of your program. You were talking about eminent domain for people that are underwater on their mortgages. I am one of those people that bought high here in Tallahassee in 2008. But leaning a little bit on conservative, you know, I've looked at myself and said, who's responsible for that decision? It's me. And I have some options. And I'm just, you know, the options are to hold on to it or to, you know, have financial difficulty with it, but it's me. It seems that when you're talking about a bank writing stuff off, the bank really doesn't write off. Somebody somewhere is going to lose money. If the home was valued at $200,000 and it's $150,000 now, they write off $50,000. Somebody has to pay that. Who is going to pay that under this scheme?
Well, right now it's going to be reduced profits for the bank. And to a certain extent, because the bank has reduced profits, that also reduces their tax liabilities, so it's less tax dollars. But Tom, this is a drop in the bucket. I'm of the opinion that, you know, we should have started out by saying, okay, if we're going to give $700 billion in tax dollars to the banks, for that amount of money, we could have just bought out all the bad mortgages in the country. Let's just buy out the mortgages. And you may be underwater, and you may be slightly underwater. You may be able to handle it. What the city of Riverside is doing, is it Riverside? Whatever the town is doing with these things, Richmond, I'm sorry, is they're looking at people who got the loans from the banksters that are the gotcha loans, the adjustable rate mortgages, the bad mortgages, the mortgages that never should have been written in the first place. People who are, you know, well over 150% underwater, people who got basically hustled. And you know, I'm all in favor of that. I get it that the official Republican position is we don't want to mess with the banksters. Somebody's going to have to pay for it eventually. It should be the homeowner. Screw the homeowner. To hell with the homeowner. I get that. But I just respectfully disagree. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
Thanks for facilitating a more candid discussion about the issues that we all face.
I'm doing my best.
Thank you. If I may just reflect on a couple of your previous callers before I make my point.
If it's brief?
Yeah. The guy that was saying that the federal government won't allow for innovation to happen from a state level, that's just painfully obvious when we look at the marijuana law, the law against farmers growing cannabis. They're not distant cousins.
Yeah.
They're the same plant.
It's not universally obvious, but it is obvious in that instance, certainly.
It is universally obvious to the whole world. The United States government is way behind on their policy on cannabis, way, way behind. And I would like to emphasize that the drops in the bucket that you refer to with the banks, those are real people, Tom. Those are real people, the drops in the bucket. Those are real people. And this really matters from the ground up is where democracy takes place. And if we're going to be true to what you say in terms of people need to show up and get organized, well, there's a lot of showing up and organized getting on, and the media is not reporting on it.
I agree. As I pointed out, it was the Occupy movement that both was pushing in San Francisco for a city-owned bank, and it was the Occupy movement that was pushing Richmond use of eminent domain. So, you know, yeah, I'm with you, Bob. Thank you for the call. Elaine in Buchanan Dam, Texas. Hey, Elaine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have something I think you might find interesting.
Yeah.
I have a friend in Massachusetts, and we talk regularly, and her brother-in-law works for the Defense Department, civilian part of it. And when we spoke, I used to hear during the conversation a loud click on the phone, and then the volume would get higher, and that would go on for a while, and I never thought much of it about it. Until I read in the newspaper, probably about 5-6 weeks ago, how the government is keeping an eye on their defense contractors and their phone calls.
Yeah.
And then what I did was, I don't believe I did this. I have another friend here in Texas, and have a little fun during our conversation, which isn't very interesting, except we do talk politics. I throw in the words bomb, incinerate, decimate, and then I have shoulder I have shoulder missiles in my.
You are a troublemaker, Elaine.
That's exactly what my friend said, Tom. And then I started using the word jihad. I'm going to do a jihad on my lousy telephone.
Yeah.
And then I'm hearing these clicking and the same clicking that I heard with her.
Elaine, in all probability, I hate to burst this particular bubble, and I may be wrong on this, but this technology is so sophisticated that there is no necessity for you to hear any clicks. I mean, that goes back to the 50s and 60s when they had hardware. So probably if you're hearing clicking on the phone, somewhere along the line, you've got some bad copper. Your phone company probably has a connection that is corroding.
My goodness, and I thought I had this down pat.
Yeah. It's just, you know, I mean, this is all done digitally. It's all done way before it gets to your house. and, you know, at the trunk stations and things. So there's really no way to know if you're being listened in on or not. And the absence or presence of clicks is probably, like I said, it's just a reflection of a bad phone line. But Elaine, I respect your spunk. Keep it up. Thanks a lot for the call. That's great. Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, got a minute to the break. It's yours.
Hey, good day, Tom. My point is that a couple of callers ago, he was talking about the banks losing money. Somebody had to lose.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing is a formula that happened clear back under George Bush. So when he has to look at this, or it's not, it's where lobbyists have allowed business to graft themselves onto government, and all of this banking fraud and the real estate fraud that brought on the crash. There was a lot of money that was made back through 2000 to 2008. That if you look at it in a period of unsustainable growth, it was going to have to crash sooner or later.
Yeah, And ultimately, if somebody is going to pay the price, you have to ask the question: should it be the banksters? Should it be the taxpayers? Or should it be the individual homeowners? And the answer to that question, since George Bush in 2007 first started addressing this issue, has been: let it be the individual homeowners who pay. And I'm telling you, they're tapped out. They can't do it anymore. Randy, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, Congressman Paul Ryan, former vice presidential candidate with Mitt Romney, has said that the reason people are, by the way, welcome back to the second hour of our program, the reason people are poor is because of anti-poverty programs. Right. Doesn't have anything to do with the trade policies that allow corporations to ship jobs overseas. Doesn't have anything to do with tax policies that allows the top 1% to have mind-boggling, that allows the 100 richest, excuse me, the 400 richest people in the United States to earn more to own more wealth than half of all other Americans. The five Walton heirs to own more wealth than a third of all Americans. Got nothing to do with any of that stuff. No, it's, as Paul Ryan said, this top-down big government approach that the president has taken, I think the evidence is very clear, has proven not to help people out of poverty, but more importantly, to trap people in poverty. He wants to have a work requirement with food stamps. It's called the Sutherland Amendment. According to the CBPP, it would allow states to end benefits for most adults who receive or apply for SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Food Stamps, including parents with young children and people with disabilities, if they are not working or participating in a worker training program for at least 20 hours a week. The amendment provides no jobs and no funds for worker training programs, and it does not require states to make work opportunities available. People wanting to work who are looking for a job but haven't found one would be cut off from food stamps. Great. This is Paul Ryan's idea of what will save America. Dr. Carol Swain is on the line with us. She's an attorney and author and professor of law at Vanderbilt University. Her website, Carol Swain, SWAIN.net. Dr. Swain, welcome back to the program.
It's my pleasure, and I'm a professor of political science and of law, with political science being my main field.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. So, you know, I know that you lean Republican, as it were. Your take on Paul Ryan's take on it's food stamps that makes people poor?
Well, we both know that it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah.
I can agree with him that the policies of the Obama administration, they certainly have not improved conditions in the black community. And I could get into a lot of issues that I think help to keep people poor. And one is the fact that we do encourage the migration of people from poor countries, and that we have people that are here that they can work three jobs and still be poor.
Yes, but can you identify one even policy that President Obama proposed that Congress has passed and has been made into law that is keeping people in poverty?
Well, I can tell you that when we had unemployment benefits extending for 99 weeks or in mm-hmm. some cases maybe beyond, I think it created a disincentive for some people to find jobs. And I know from my own personal experiences involving a relative, the day after the unemployment benefits ended, within a couple of days, that person was employed. But at the time that the unemployment benefits ended, the unemployment office itself, you know, provided all the information about food stamps, and there was a big push to get this person on food stamps, even though they were in a situation that they actually didn't need food stamps.
So what
they were living at home. They had plenty of food.
Sure. So, I get it that there are going to be people who abuse the system, and there are going to people, you know, there are going to be free riders. It's intrinsic in any system.
The prescription is that.
But does that mean that we should throw out the whole system?
No. The problem with his prescription is that it really doesn't take into consideration the people that actually do need some assistance. And some of them are people that are working to pay their rent.
Right.
And that they have to make a choice between buying food or paying their rent. And that's something that there is a segment of the Republican community that doesn't quite get it because they've never been there.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is, I mean, I think we pretty much know what the progressive solutions are. You know, let's change our trade policies. Let's change our taxation policies. Let's raise the minimum wage. Let's make sure everybody has a basic.
Let's bring in more poor people. That's the progressive solution.
Well, let's legalize the poor people who are here, and
yes,
which will cause their wages to go up, which and will stop the kind of gray market economy where they can be exploited.
The budget office figures, data, you know, in
sure.
the report that they put out included the fact that if the amnesty bill is passed, that unemployment will rise. And we know the group that it's going to rise on is going to be African Americans who are already overrepresented among the unemployed. And it also said that the wages of the average American, and that's working people and people, maybe some of the people that watch your show, will go down. And so that's not going to help us. There are a lot of people that,
assumes
we might call them middle class, but they're still poor because of these kinds of policies. And what's wrong in America is we're not investing in our human capital.
I don't disagree with you. I would love to see, you know, college and trade schools absolutely free for everybody. It used to be that you could get a decent job and raise a family with a high school diploma. Back, you know, 100 years ago, you could get a decent job and raise a family with an eighth grade diploma. And so we used to pay to eighth grade, and then, you know, it was 12th grade. And now it's, you know, 12th grade plus four. And I think that we should be covering that. But, or that in a trade school, 12th grade plus two or whatever it takes. But are you suggesting that we should keep everything static? I mean, those CBO figures assume that there's no change in trade policy, assume that there's no expansion of infrastructure or other, you know, any kind of, you know, let's not do anything in America. Let's just follow the Republican path and not grow this country. If we have a choice between legalizing the people who are here. And yes, I don't disagree with you, actually, you know, where you're expanding your labor force and actually probably before that. But in any case, you're expanding your labor force. That is going to drop wages. But there are a lot of things we can do to compensate for that. We could bring these jobs. We can bring jobs back home as a starting point. What's wrong with that?
We have not done it, and I don't see the incentive. And
well, we haven't done it because Republicans are fighting it.
I'm frustrated with both political parties, and when you get them close together, there's not that much difference, especially in the Senate. And so I don't see that either political party is really proposing solutions that's going to help America.
Well, Nancy Pelosi actually passed a bill out of the House of Representatives, sent it to the Senate, that would do away with the tax advantage that companies get by moving work offshore and by keeping their money offshore. It's the scam that Apple's running on us, and it would have done away with that. And
but
there,
you know,
was there were enough Democrats
really
not in the Senate to vote for it, but the Republicans filibustered it.
Well, one of the things that we need is for the population to be more educated about the choices before them. And again, I think both political parties come up short.
So, what's your alternative?
Well,
or solution.
My alternative is to again to educate the public and to get more people involved. But right now,
how do we do that?
It's like the worst time to be legalizing people that are undocumented under the plan that I have seen proposed, because it's just going to expand the poverty rolls in America.
Well,
we don't have the
resources over a 13-year period
to support the people that we already have.
Yeah, and like I said, I don't entirely disagree with that argument. And, in fact, I've been making that argument for a lot of years. But that said, there is so much that we can do that Republicans are refusing to do.
Well, I don't agree with Paul Ryan, and I'm not a Paul Ryan supporter. So
yeah.
I can't defend what he said or a lot that comes from the Republican Party.
Yeah. Okay. Carol,
I wish I could, but I can't.
Okay. And frankly, there's a lot out of the Democratic Party that I can't defend. So maybe we're in the same boat. Dr. Carol Swain, attorney, author, and professor of political science and law at Vanderbilt University. Website, Carol M. Swain, MSWAIN.net. Thank you, Dr. Swain.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, what is the Republican solution? I'm still searching, just like I'm trying to figure out why the Republicans flip the stars upside down on the flag. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, and Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, I wanted to touch on a number of issues. And firstly, with regard to that caller, I think that, you know, you were going in exactly the right direction. I mean, should we line up the members of every team of the NFL because they touched the skin of a dead pig on a Sunday?
Right. This is just for our listeners who may not know what you're talking about. We had a caller earlier who said that he or she disagreed. It's a kind of an androgynous name, Alex, I'm not sure, disagreed with the idea that gay people should have rights and should be free, should have legal protections against discrimination, because it's in the Old Testament that people should, men should not lie with men. And I said, you know, that's in the same part of Deuteronomy and Leviticus where it says that you shall not eat shellfish. And so should we be putting out of business all the Red Lobster stores, you know, restaurants in America?
You get these, you know, obscure and fleeting references, and it's interesting how the right wants to focus on these sorts of things rather than, you know, if we take it from a different perspective, say quantitatively, you know, there are some between 2,000 and 3,000 references to poverty and what we owe to the poor in the Bible.
Yes.
Yet, you know, based on the number of references alone, one would think that that's the priority, not these sort of, you know, fleeting few references that are obscure and are found in the Old Testament. I mean, let's talk about where the Bible focuses.
Yeah.
And it focuses on talking about, you know, where what we owe to the poor and the lesser among us. So why exactly are they so selective? But, of course, you know, we all know the answer to that question.
Right. It's a rationalization for bigotry.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I did want to ask the question, which is why I called in, because you had a caller yesterday. And I did agree in terms of the way that you were dealing with it in terms of the question of race and, you know, his sort of contention that Europeans were somehow inherently superior to other groups and whatnot.
Well, this is the guy who said that that African-Americans are practicing reverse racism and that the proof of the inferiority, I guess, of African-Americans, of people of color in general, was that Africa has a lot of resources and is not an incredibly prospering continent. And I pointed out that it's only, you know, 1965 was when Churchill pulled England out of Uganda. I've been there. I've been in Sudan. I've been in many of these countries, these former colonies, and colonialism is still echoing there. It's just like, you know, slavery and racism is still echoing here. This has nothing to do with race. It has to do purely with exploitation. Pardon me for interrupting.
I think you're right. Is there a distinction that we can make, however, between racism and ethnocentrism? There are great many authors and scholars who look at, for instance, you know, the differences between Northern Europe, Central Europe, Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, and look at the way that historically, especially Northwestern Europe, embraced the concepts of the Enlightenment, reason, rationality, logic, scientific method, and cultivated those ideas over centuries such that they did develop an advantage over other parts of the world, where you know we don't have a criminal justice system in the West that says, you know, my aunt woke up this morning and said she had a dream that such and such committed a crime, so therefore we're going to use this sort of superstitious nonsense to prosecute someone.
Right.
So,
which was actually done in Massachusetts, by the way, in the 17th century.
Yeah, exactly, centuries ago. So I. At what point do we recognize, because I don't want to throw out the entire field of social science, especially sociology, that recognizes that there are differences among societies, and at some point is it incumbent upon us to be honest and say that those differences will result in advantage for some people and disadvantage for others, having, again, embraced certain concepts?
I think you're right. And both ethnocentrism and classism, to the extent that you can define it, I think you could say the same about both. Now, the difference between the two, of course, is that public policy can shift people in and out of classes and does regularly, whereas it can't shift people in and out of culture, out of ethnic background, out of heritage, as it were. But I think you're absolutely right. The one caveat that I would put in there, though, is to be very, very careful of, is that we have Western European culture, to say, largely white culture, but there are many people of color who are fully members and fully embrace all the ideals of that culture. We have for many years been saying to people who are not part of our culture, whether it's the Potawatomi in the rainforests of Brazil, or whether it's people in Eastern Europe who are living in the gypsies, you know, the Roma people, or whoever it may be. We have said to them, the people all over the world, we would be glad to embrace you if you just become just like us. We've said this to Native Americans. And what this really is, in many cases, sometimes it's genuinely benevolent or useful, but in many cases what it is the velvet glove over the iron fist of a dominator culture that is destroying the cultures, religions, languages, and histories of other people. And we have to be very, very careful about that.
You're absolutely correct, but I would ask you, is that an inevitability, given that the world is becoming more homogeneous in terms of our technology, communication? We share much more than we ever did before in terms of common culture and values and so forth, and that was inevitably going to be the case, in the same way that, you know, one village that was 10 miles away from another village 5,000 years ago might have had independent cultures. But over the centuries, it was going to simply be the case that whether they were going to assimilate, they were going to merge, and at some point in the world, there probably is going to be one language.
English has become pretty much the default language.
Exactly.
And if you go back to the 18th century, it was French, actually, was the default language of the world. You know, it was used for diplomacy and for communication. And you could go back, you know, 2 millennia ago, and it was Latin. You know, I was going to say Roman. It's Latin. But I think that you're right, and that's why it's so incumbent upon us who are members of this dominator culture, the one that is most rapidly spreading around the world, to do everything we can to make this culture more humane, more human, more sensitive to life and the issues of the planet, and make it a better culture. Makes sense?
And recognize that these cultures, though they may not be in tune with what we may consider important, that they have a lot to contribute, and
some
issues, they were right, and we perhaps are not always right.
Yes, absolutely. And again, always be very, very careful about that iron glove or iron fist thing. Steve, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, this is a very, almost an academic way of getting into the whole Bill O'Reilly rant, but it's basically that whole same issue, which... Welcome back. You will recall that in North Carolina, the governor, Pat McCrory, he said back when he was campaigning for governor that if a highly restrictive abortion bill like the one that he just signed was presented to him, he would veto it. He did not veto, or he would refuse to sign it. He did not refuse to sign it. He did sign it. There have been pro-reproductive rights activists in North Carolina demonstrating out in front of the governor's mansion continuously pretty much since then. And yesterday afternoon, McCrory, the governor, along with four of his security guards, most of the people out there protesting are women, The governor went out and handed the women a plate of cookies and said, God bless you. God, these are for you. God bless you. God bless you. God bless you. Like, Domini, 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 you're all Catholic now, or some, you know, variation on the old fire sign theater routine. The ladies did not appreciate this. The women who received the cookies were like, cookies? Are you telling us to go back to our kitchens? Really? And the governor just turned around and went back into his mansion. The women left the cookies at the gate of the mansion, along with a sign that said, Governor McCrory, we prefer women's health over cookies. You may have your cookies back, yes. We want women's health care, not cookies, is what the note said. They've now got this new tweet, this new hashtag, let them eat cookies. Amanda Marcotte over at Slate points out, she says, while it's unlikely that McCrory was deliberately trying to tell the protesters to know their place, that's how the gestures read. She notes, next to sandwiches, cookies are probably the most potent edible symbol of the belief that a woman's role is to shut up, give up their ambitions, and return to the kitchen. In fact, when he handed the cookies to the women, they began chanting, hey, Pat, that was rude. You wouldn't give cookies to a dude. Cool. Okay, Charles in Montgomery, Illinois. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Okay, Tom. You had that fellow yesterday talking about reverse racism,
mm-hmm.
and I know it's already been covered, but I have another take on it. I also grew up in the Chicagoland area at a high school that had combined two different community school districts. One was a very progressive district that always had the best schools, and the other was a community that very Republican, did not want to spend any additional money on its schools, even when Ronald Reagan cut the Ronald Reagan did his cuts of elementary education throughout the 80s. And what wound up happening is that school district wound up virtually going broke. And our school district, yeah, we wound up, you know, all the citizens in the community wound up paying more taxes. But with the high school, I was finding that a lot of these kids from other community, they were all taught basically, you know, to deal with the tests. You know, no critical thinking really was taught. Nothing was stressed. And I'm seeing a lot of that with people who are, you know, basically zombies watching Fox News and repeating everything that they are told.
Yeah, this is the consequence of, you know, of No Child Left Behind.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And they've been trying to make, trying to pacify, dummy up the citizenry since Ronald Reagan took office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree, Charles, and you know, the war on public education is a threefer for Republicans. One, they get to dumb down the populace, which, you know, anybody who's working in the interests exclusively of large transnational corporations and wealthy people appreciates. Number two, they get to break unions, teachers' unions, and specifically, and number three, they get to cut their own taxes. So, you know, it's like, geez. Anyhow, Charles, thank you for sharing that. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey.
To your point about the $700 billion stimulus that never really happened, if you recall, if my memory serves correct, there was three selling points behind the stimulus.
Yeah, are you talking about that stimulus or are you talking about the TARP? Because I was talking earlier about the two TARP programs that George Bush passed, which were $700 billion, bailing out the banks.
Right. Sometimes I confuse it, too, when I'm not clear in my thinking. But anyway, the three selling points back then was that, number one, we needed to invest in our infrastructure for obvious reasons.
Okay. That was the stimulus that followed, yes. Okay.
Right. Number two was manufacturing retail stimulation, which has a multiplier effect,
right.
Also good for employment. And number three, investment in human capital,
right.
i.e. education, returning to school, finishing your college degree, or getting vocational training if you or one of your children needed it.
Right.
So with that in mind, if you take 14 million households and you divide that $700 billion directly to those 14 million households and you administer it with some caseworkers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I know Republicans hate the idea of socialized approaches to stuff, but their approach doesn't work. That comes out to 280,000 households per state, $50,000 per household.
Mm-hmm.
So you could consider that's enough money to do some retrofitting of your roof, to put up some solar panels, or maybe put up the white guckenpokey that reflects sunlight, or a basic roof repair for houses damaged in a hurricane. You can repair or upgrade your automobile, your transportation for the family. And you'll have money left over to return and finish some school or college or vocational training, which you could even have money to go into a cooperative business with a group of your friends and neighbors.
Right. And instead what we got was banksters who were mere millionaires. Becoming billionaires.
Right. And the proof is in the pudding that they will not take this approach with the American people because the Republicans or the people who pay them have a stranglehold on the media and the discourse, except for, you know, a few media outlets, stuff like Democracy Now! And You and a few others and The Nation magazine. But, you know, the thought process is pretty much bungled up in their favor.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the solution is to get the word out, unless you have some thoughts about that.
Well, I think that if everybody tells 10 friends, I mean, you know, we need to be as viral as possible, whether it's on social media or whether it's walking next door and having coffee with somebody or getting out and participating with any local group at all. You know, find groups of like-minded people or find groups of very different-minded people and hang out with them and spread the word. I think that it's a shoe-leather issue. This is, you know, Bernie Sanders says this every single Friday. It's all about movement politics. We need to build movements. So, Johnny, thank you for the call. I'm with you on that. Ted in Palos Hills. Palos Hills. Hey, Ted, what's up?
Tom, thank you for taking my call. University of Tom Hartman for 3 years now. A couple of things I just wanted to say real quick is that, you know, you always talk about how the day of the inauguration, they were plotting essentially to damage Obama's presidency so badly in order to take it back just here earlier this year. Mm-hmm. They're doing the same thing right now with Hillary, and they know Hillary's a shoo-in candidate. And what they're doing is that they're trying to get people to not vote. And what they're doing is they're trying to make some dichotomy between the two parties and to get us less enthusiastic about voting. They're planning this right now.
Sure.
The lady that you were with the immigration, same lady. She was just saying that immigration is the reason why the poor communities, like where I grew up in Chicago, is the reason why we don't have jobs. They know that Obama is going to launch this legislation. And if they blame it on that, then it's essentially blaming Obama for the reason why we're in poverty. You know, and a couple of things that I've seen just here with your last caller, I want to say, like with Detroit, like currently I live in a suburb of Chicago, and there was a program here called Section 8 Housing, and there used to be a lot of project buildings downtown in the prime area of Chicago, prime real estate, really expensive real estate. There are project buildings right down there, Cabrini Green, et cetera. Some of them are really famous, Ida B. Wells,
mm-hmm.
Lots of crime. They created this program, Section 8 Housing, and they made the benefit. I'm currently a landlord myself, and I have very good tenants that are Section 8 Housing. As a matter of fact, one of them just got a job, and she's not even on it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is that the people who lived in these poor project areas were moved out into suburban areas. There's places near me right now, apartment complexes, and the neighborhood here is diverse. And I think what I've seen happening is that the kids are going to school with more diverse children. Okay, they're starting to see a different level of opportunity. They're starting to see kids, their peers now, okay, go to college, get jobs, and they're kind of doing the same thing. And also, because it's not such a crime-laden area, the crime's a little bit less in the surrounding areas, surrounding suburban areas, Chicago, the police are a little bit more strict.
Yeah.
There, the crime weighed down.
There was an interesting op-ed about this that I read yesterday on one of the progressive websites about how back in the 60s, there was a professor of sociology who was predicting that the urbanization trend that we were following would be dangerous in this regard. Ted, excellent point. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The idea of basically isolating poverty in an urban environment is ultimately not a good thing. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. Hey, Congressman, how you doing?
How are you?
I am fine, thank you. I hope you are well.
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. So what's going on in the world?
Well, we've got a lot of things in the world. Senator McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham, and I think maybe some Democratic members are talking about running over to Egypt and to at least get some commitments of an election so that we don't have to cut off money. But a surprise visit was made to Pakistan by Secretary of State Kerry in an effort to basically maybe restart, jumpstart relationship between the two countries, if that's really possible with a fresh face. But he made an unannounced visit, which just happened. And there was just a breaking news story that the United States has come to some type of new agreement, and it just says United States, on staying past 2014, post-2014 in Afghanistan, and we are awaiting President Karzai to say yes or no to the plan.
That's which very is interesting. I'm guessing he'll say yes if we continue to give him huge bribes, and he'll say no if we don't.
Well, you hit the nail on the head, Tom, because the analysts are going to exactly make that point that Karzai will use this. This is not going to come as a quick answer. He will, string us around and then do what he does best, and his nephew or whoever that protects the equipment by paying him so that Taliban can blow it up later will make money. And that's just about the bottom line of it.
Yep. George Bush has gotten us into some pretty bad situations.
No exit plan, and the exit plan now might be delayed again. The information and the news on the Hill, at least, we're talking about delays because we don't have a budget. But it's interesting watching Speaker John Boehner, who is meeting with the Republicans in a closed-door session, but we know what he's talking about. He is saying, don't shut the government down. They're looking at maybe going a little bit more than conservatives want, but less than what the president wants on a continuing resolution. And what he's offering to his members is, hey, we're going to get rid of Obamacare. We're just going to cut it in pieces here and there. We're going to keep doing votes. But what this is, Boehner is terrified because he was there when I was there with the government shutdown that lasted 20-some days. He doesn't want a repeat of that. So he's offering some other way to destroy Obamacare, which will not be successful, but they could maybe delay or tweak.
Well, isn't he really offering another way to make the rabid right base, the Tea Party base, believe that the Republicans are trying to stop Obamacare and not do it?
And make them believe that they actually can stop it.
Right, so that they'll vote for him in the primary and all his buddies.
Yeah. This is the Democratic side on Capitol Hill for a variety of things, and other issues came up like the voting rights card.
Now, I have a theory about that. Glenn Greenwald was supposed to testify before Congress today, flew up here from South America.
Yeah.
And he was going to lay out all of the stuff about the NSA's brand new XY something or other program, X-Keyscore program. And that had to be postponed because the president just suddenly decided to go visit Congress. I think that there's a cause-effect relationship there. What do you think?
All of it had to be postponed. I thought it was a strange thing because, I'm having a senior moment here. Congressman Grayson?
Mm-hmm. Alan Grayson was the one doing it.
Alan Grayson. He was in on the hearing. So, you had a lot of mixed bag people that were looking at this. I thought it was going to be a great hearing, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, it does get canceled. Now, the Senate hearing went on, and Leahy took, you know, the NSA to task. But I think it's very interesting, the timing. I thought that today when I saw that, the timing that created the other committee to be disbanded for today.
Yeah, I don't think it was any coincidence. I think the White House said, we do not want Glenn Greenwald in front of the television cameras talking to Congress. And
I thought it would be a great hearing. And then, of course, the president, his issues got a little bit sidetracked because the first thing out of the box was Larry Summers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he got hit with. And then he vigorously defended Larry Summers and said, well, the chips will fall where they may on it. But, you know, he vigorously defended him. So the preoccupation was with Larry Summers at first, and then the president could get to his agenda.
Yeah. Yeah. Larry Summers, what a walking train wreck.
I have to tell you, Robert Rubin, of course, wants Larry Summers to be in there. And Rubin was absolutely no friend to organized labor by any stretch of the imagination. He did everything humanly possible to hurt on the trade issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fact. And Rubin and the Wall Street crowd, if I can just editorialize on this for a second, are behind Summers. It's a very clear-cut situation, who's behind whom.
Yeah.
And Summers haven't even gotten to the women's issues yet.
Yes.
It's bad.
Yeah. I think that if the president puts Summers, and what you and I are talking about, for people who don't have, have missed this story, somehow, is that the term of Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, is about to expire. It's going to expire at year's end. And the president has to appoint a replacement. And the two people running are, I'm forgetting the name of the woman who is the number two person at the Fed right now, but she's candidate number one, and Larry Summers is candidate number two. Depending on who you ask, the order might be reversed. And she seems like she's a reasonable, thoughtful person who's going to maintain policies as they are and all this kind of thing. And Larry Summers is a toady for Wall Street. In my opinion,
horrible track record. Also, he, again, the issues of what he has said with women's issues, both at Harvard, and other statements is just absolutely reprehensible. It's not good whatsoever.
Yeah. He's a walking train wreck. But he's Wall Street's walking train wreck, so the president has to seriously consider him. I have a feeling at the last minute he's not going to put him in. If he does, I think he's going to pay a huge political price.
Huge price on it.
And so is the country, because Larry Summers will pursue policies that work for the banksters and screw the average American. Mm-hmm. He always has. He always will.
Yes, correct.
So I think that's sure enough, we're out of time.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bob. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. And
hey,
we'll be back.
Harman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program.
We'll be back with the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber, the president of the NAACP of North Carolina and the founder of Moral Monday. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Third hour of our program, 5 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and the Reverend William Barber is on the line with us, president of the NAACP of North Carolina, the website NAACPNC, as in North Carolina, .org. Reverend Barber, welcome back to the program.
Tom, I'm always glad to be on with you. Last time I was in a church with hundreds and hundreds of people getting ready to go to jail.
How did that work out?
Well, on that particular day, over 100 people went in to exercise their constitutional rights, and for doing that, we were arrested. But, you know, the Moral Monday campaign is really more than about going to jail. It's about just exposing a shameful condition of extremism and immorality by this extreme left that has attacked the poor, attacked the sick, attacked children, attacked workers, and now has crimes against democracy by literally trying to roll back every progressive voting mechanism in our state and making North Carolina the worst voter suppression state in the nation.
Yeah. And on top of this, they also gave rich people a huge tax cut and raised taxes on working and poor people, which
exactly.
Which is, you know, who's paying their tune is the fat cats. Moral Mondays have been growing. They're starting to get good national attention. I think this is absolutely marvelous. You guys are calling out what everybody from Art Pope to the Governor Pat McCrory and everybody else is doing there. Last week, I heard a news report that last week, or maybe it was this week, was supposed to be the last one, and I assumed that was because it tied into a legislative schedule, but I'm guessing it's not the last one. Tell me about this.
No. This movement is a four-pronged strategy. We have a legal strategy. We have a voter education, voter registration strategy. We have an internet social media strategy, and we had a civil disobedience strategy. The legislature has run home. After they did their dirt, they ran home. And, in fact, they even gave themselves power to represent themselves in state court and undermine the attorney general. I mean, crowd is just very extreme. So now we're going home behind them. We've only suspended Moral Monday until they come back. We're going home behind them. And we began on this coming August the 5th in Asheville, North Carolina. There will be Mountain Moral Monday. And Tom, you would understand this, the phenomenon of that. The NAACP in the South leading an effort that's 50% white, and now we're going to take civil rights activism and hook it with mountain populism in the South. That's the kind of movement and fusion that can turn the tide of public, turn the tide of our electoral politics.
It is, and hopefully it will. And in fact, we're on the air on a radio station in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm sure this is good news for the town. Let me restart this question. What direction do you see? I mean, clearly we have seen now North Carolina for several years as Art Pope and other right wingers and have been pouring all this money in, and they've been basically buying the state and buying the legislature and flipping the governor's seat Republican, flipping the legislature Republican, and then disenfranchising millions and millions of people and trying to set it up for the future. How goes the backlash to that? I know the Moral Monday thing is, you know, more and more people are showing up every week and more people are getting active. I have to believe that it's also in other areas, that there are other symptoms and signs that the backlash is growing.
Oh, no doubt. And that's exactly what Moral Monday was designed to do, to wake up the consciousness of people, because they had hoped that we would just be amicable and just say, well, they're depressed, there's nothing we could do, and just kind of put our tail between our legs and go home. Instead, every Monday, all the major media, even national media, even in Australia, has been presenting the issues, not just people mad, but the issues, and showing a diverse agenda-based coalition that's standing against this extremism. We have named them. We have shown the numbers of people that are hurting. So what has happened in 13 weeks? Their poll numbers have dropped so bad that they are now less than one out of every five North Carolinians agrees with them.
Wow.
Moral Mondays has become more popular than the legislature and is growing in popularity. And in the South, for a movement led by the NAACP to basically have been endorsed by all the major papers, that's a phenomenon in itself.
Mm-hmm.
I saw where Pat McCrory is now listed as one of the 18 worst governors. And then on another site, Moral Monday is listed as one of the top 40 movements in the world.
Wow.
So it's not only thousands of people coming, it's the makeup of those people, it's the energy that's happening in the state, it's the shaking of the consciousness. You can't go anywhere now and not hear people talking about it. I get on a plane, people say, hey, Moral Monday. I was at the NAACP National Convention in Orlando, people are talking about it. We've received nearly 700,000 hits on our social media since we started. This is a movement, a transformative movement, and it's different than Tea Party and Wisconsin and all that, because it's not something that just spontaneously happened. We've been building for 7 years, and they are reacting by political paranoia. They are scared to death of the changing demographics. And if people wake up, what's going to happen in 2014, 2016, and beyond?
Yeah. Yeah, this is the kind of story that I love people to hear, because I get, you know, people call into the program all the time and they're like, well, you know, it looks like the Republicans, just look at what they got away with in Wisconsin. Look at what they got away with in Michigan. Look at what they just did in North Carolina. You know, what can I do? And I'm like, get active, get organized, get out there on the ground, find a local movement. And in North Carolina, you are providing one. You are absolutely doing God's work, sir. This is an absolutely marvelous, marvelous event. What are the best ways that somebody who's not in North Carolina, we're talking with Dr. William J. Barber II, the president of the NAACP of North Carolina and one of the founders and organizers of this whole Moral Monday program, a big Monday, big program coming up August 5th in Asheville, North Carolina, by the way, a heads up for everybody, NAACPNC.org, the website. And what, for people who are not in North Carolina, what is your advice? How can they, A, help you guys, and B, possibly start their own? Are you hearing about people talking about starting a Moral Monday program in Detroit or in Minneapolis or, you know, some of these other cities in states that are under assault by, you know, wealthy billionaire families in those states that are funding right-wing causes?
I am. In fact, I'm on a call tomorrow at 2 o'clock with a bunch of people from throughout the South. I think what the first thing people need to do is recognize, I believe we're in the middle of a third reconstruction. I believe that the electorate that elected President Obama was a signal and a sign of that. And that's why the ultra conservative extreme right is fighting so hard. They noted that the electoral dynamics are changing in the South. For instance, North Carolina, 25% electorate is black, 4% Latino. That means you only need about 21% of white people to vote, the progressive whites to vote their fear, their future, not their fears. So they know that there's a future out there they cannot stop. They're trying to delay it. So number one, we need to get our heads up. We need to understand people don't fight you this hard if they're not afraid of you.
Yep.
Number two, we need to call everybody, you know, text everybody, you know, tweet everybody, you know, in North Carolina and tell them to be engaged, because we believe Raleigh is the new Selma. That we've got to stop them here in a progressive state to help others believe in possibility in their state. Last few things, you know, go on our website. If you're in Asheville, come out. And then we're going to be doing Coastal Mall Monday on the 28th of actual 50th anniversary of March in Washington. We're going to do 13 rallies in 13 congressional districts in the 13 hometown of the 13 congresspersons. We are building and building, and then every month we're going to do Moral Monday somewhere all the way through the next election. And we've had 960 people arrested. They are each going to register now 50 people a month, register 50 new voters a month. That's 1,000 people a month.
That is.
We've got to organize, strategize, and keep the same.
There you go. Absolutely brilliant. The Reverend Dr. William J. Barber, the second president of the NAACP of North Carolina. Get over to their website, NAACPNC.org. Sir, thank you for being with us.
No, thank you so much for having us. God bless.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'll take all the blessings I can get. This is actually, you know, like I said, it's a good news day. I agree with him. I think this is the third reconstruction. Well, pile this into the category of oops, but it really highlights the problem the New York City Police Department has. They have a three-star chief. And from my limited understanding of the hierarchy, I mean, police departments are organized much like militaries, and my understanding is that a three-star chief is sort of like a three-star general in the police department. This is the highest-ranking African-American officer in the New York City Police Department. Sitting in his car, out of uniform, outside a house in Queens, and he's been profiled. Black guy on the street. And the police come up to him with guns drawn. Guns out. Very strange. Okay, number one. Just a few interesting stories in the news I wanted to share with you today. Another, this over at Daily Kos, that we have been hearing now from the president and all the way down to the natural gas industry, which loves to buy ads on network television and give them lots and lots of dollars so they don't talk about them on the news, that emissions, carbon dioxide emissions in the United States, fell 4% last year, and isn't that a wonderful thing? And it's because we're using more natural gas. Turns out, not true. It's because we're driving more efficient cars, mostly. And because we were weatherizing homes, and because our winter wasn't quite so severe. It's got nothing to do with transferring over to natural gas. In fact, natural gas, great op-ed about this in the New York Times day before yesterday, natural gas and the process of drilling it is just as dirty as coal. Because of the, you know, anything more than 3%, any amount of leakage from a well or a wellhead that exceeds 3% causes natural gas to be just as dirty as coal. And it is. So that's going on. Now, y'all remember the story about the police officer down in Florida who called up, who was, you know, good friends with George Zimmerman and called him up and said, apparently called him up and said, hey, come on down here. We got an accident and you can help some folks out. And, you know, whether he actually was there to help them out or whether he just showed up or tried to be there for the camera or who knows what. But must be another cop in Texas called him up or something. I don't know. But George Zimmerman, according to TMZ, according to reports from TMZ, which may or may not be credible, but I'm assuming so. It's been reprinted in the Huffington Post and over at, you know, at the at Raw Story and other places. George Zimmerman was pulled over speeding in Texas, the town of Forney, Texas. And the question that the police officer asked him was, what are you doing? Where are you going? And he said, nowhere in particular. Where are you going? Nowhere in particular. But not only was he pulled over, not only was he speeding, but he had a gun in the glove box, which he informed the police of as they were walking up to his car. So our George Zimmerman alert for the day. The governor of North Carolina, after signing this, arguably one of the most restrictive abortion bills in the country, after pledging not to, by the way, when he ran for governor, there were a bunch of women protesting this out in front of the governor's mansion, have been for days, and he walked out today, or yesterday afternoon, and, along with four security officers, and gave them a plate of cookies. Here, ladies, have some cookies. Now, please go back to your kitchens. I think they got the message. His actual words were, these are for you. God bless you, God bless you, and God bless you. But they put a sign. They handed the cookies back. I mean, he had already run back inside, but they slipped the plate of cookies under the mansion gates with a note that said, we want women's health care, not cookies. So they chose not to eat the cookies. And now Twitter has gone nuts with let them eat cookies, this hashtag. Paul Ryan has come out and said that poor people are in poverty because of food stamps. The Republicans, as you know, particularly in the House of Representatives, they want to knock 5 million people off food stamps, off SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's part of the Farm Bill negotiations. Cut $22 billion out, knock 5 million people off food stamps. And in the process, they've been saying, well, you know, this... Well, here's what Paul Ryan said. He's talking about food stamps. He says, the top-down big government approach that the president has taken, I think the evidence is very clear, has proven not to help people out of poverty, but more importantly, to trap people in poverty. Right. So the math has been done. The studies have been done. The science has been done. If 5 million people are knocked off food stamps, it will save that money. But it'll actually cost the government more money in increased health care costs because people who don't have food stamps buy the cheapest food they can find, which is the crappiest food that they can find, which is the most likely to cause obesity and heart disease and high blood pressure and all these other conditions. And then you've got, you know, and particularly, in fact, they just looked at type 2 diabetes, just type 2 diabetes, knocking 5 million people off the food stamps rolls over this period of time will cause an increase in $15 billion in health care costs just from maintaining the type 2 diabetes. So don't feed people well? Guess what? It actually costs more to not feed them than it costs to feed them. But the Republicans are still going gung-ho on this. They absolutely want to say to the poor people, You know, well, if you want food, go stand outside the governor's mansion in North Carolina. He'll bring you cookies. Meanwhile, survey just came out. 4 out of 5 Americans will face poverty-level circumstances at some point in their lives. 4 out of 5. And Paul Ryan wants to make sure that they don't have food stamps available to them. And the FBI did a sting operation, did a major bust the other day in child prostitution, arrested 150 people, and freed 150 children who were prostitutes, some as young as 9 to 11 years old. This is the result of poverty. These children, virtually all of them, were children of great poverty, living on the streets, homeless, who had been, you know, lured into this with promises of food and shelter and other things. This should not be happening in the United States. You don't find this happening in Sweden. This should not be happening in the United States.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The conservative policies in a very real way are contributing to child prostitution. Good, the bad, and the very, very impignorantly ugly, the good. Jeremy Scahill, during a Tuesday guest appearance on Democracy Now!, the Nation magazine reporter blasted the mainstream media for not paying enough attention to the Bradley Manning trial. Check it out.
The corporate media coverage of this trial, which is arguably one of the most important cases in modern American history, has been utterly shameful. When you look at how CNN and MSNBC and Fox News covered the Jody Arias trial, where all of cable news was turned into one big Nancy Grace Christmas. And then you look at the utter lack of coverage. Corporate journalists who basically systematically whited out the coverage of the Bradley Manning hearing.
Well said, Jeremy. If the media really wants to turn the news into a glorified soap opera, they should at least try to dramatize events that actually matter, you know, like the trial of one of the biggest whistleblowers in American history. The bad. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, while speaking at the Heritage Foundation on Tuesday, the Tea Party's favorite senator called out the Obama administration for trying to shut down the government. No, seriously. He said the Obama administration wants to shut down the government. Listen.
We have voted to fund the federal government. We want to fund the federal government. Why is President Obama threatening to shut down the federal government? Because he wants to force Obamacare down people's throats.
Actually, you know, it's Senator Cruz who says he wants to shut down the government. He and a bunch of other far-right Republicans, like Utah Senator Mike Lee, have spent the past week threatening to reject the spending bill necessary to keep the federal government open past September 30th unless Congress defunds Obamacare. This level of dishonesty is just amazing, even by Ted Cruz's Republican stance. Obamacare is the law. Get used to it. And the very, very ugly USA Today. On Tuesday, that newspaper published an editorial by Nicholas Cummings in which the former psychologist defended the practice of ex-gay therapy. In that editorial, Cummings wrote, "Of the patients I oversaw who sought to change their sexual orientation, hundreds were successful, accusing professionals across the country who provided treatment for fully informed persons seeking to change their sexual orientation of perpetrating a fraud serves only to stigmatize the professional and shame the patient." End of quote. Cummings must be imagining things because, according to the American Psychological Association, gay reparative therapy not only is totally ineffective, but actually can be harmful. And to answer Cummings' point about stigmatization, this ex-gay therapy encourages the worst sort of stereotypes about gays because it treats sexual orientation like a mental illness. The fact that or a sin. The fact that USA Today would even consider this kind of hateful pseudoscience is just very, very ugly. It's mind-bogglingly ugly. Okay. San Francisco is thinking of opening their own bank. We want to salute them for that and encourage them to do that. And the latest Ed Snowden dump via Glenn Greenwald. I'm guessing Glenn Greenwald had this some long time ago, because Ed Snowden has promised Putin that he's not going to dump any more stuff into the news. But the latest dump from Ed Snowden is this program by the NSA called the X Keyscore program, which mines internet browsing information that the this is from the New York Times, Charlie Savage's article, browsing information that the agency is apparently vacuuming up at 150 network sites around the world. Very entertaining. There's a great thread, Kay Pete, writing over at democraticunderground.com about what Bradley Manning revealed, lest we forget. And I think most people have. He published the Iraq war logs. Actually, he didn't publish them. He gave them to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks published them, which revealed that thousands, this is from Kay Pete's post, which revealed that thousands of prisoners, of reports of prisoner abuse and torture have been filed against the Iraqi security forces. So for the first time, we got to see the horrors of the Iraqi army that we had put together and armed and financed. U.S. defense contractors were brought under tighter supervision after leaked diplomatic cables revealed that they had been complicit in child trafficking activities. Yes. $2 billion a year in revenue from the U.S. government. One company gets that much, and they threw a party for Afghan security recruits featuring boys purchased from child traffickers for entertainment. No, I'm not making this up. It's true. The Guantanamo files described how detainees were arrested based on what the New York Times referred to as highly subjective evidence. Another one. You know, innocent prisoners, in other words, being arrested. Here's another one. Even though the Bush and Obama administrations maintained publicly that there was no official count of civilian casualties, in fact, they tried to imply there were no civilian casualties, the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs actually showed that our government counted a total of 109 deaths in Iraq, with 66,000 classified as non-combatants. That's civilians. 66,000 people in 1 year, between 2004 and 2009, during those 5 years, 66,081 people that the Bush and Cheney administration knew they had killed, who had nothing to do with anything. Just people living their lives. The blood of 66,081 people on the hands of George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Alberto Gonzalez, Paul Wolfowitz. The list goes on and on. U.S. military officials withheld information. This also, the stuff that Bradley Manning revealed. U.S. military officials withheld information about the indiscriminate killing of the Reuters journalists and innocent Iraqi civilians. That was the video that he released. Remember that? The from the helicopter gunship killing these guys? It's pretty awful stuff. And they had been lying to us about it. Our own government had been lying to us about what our own military was doing in the middle of our very own war. The State Department backed corporate opposition to a Haitian minimum wage law. Very interesting. The U.S. government had been faking its public support for the president of Tunisia, Ben Ali. This, some suggest, led to the Tunisian uprising, which was the beginning of the Arab Spring. Bradley Manning's leak. We learned that Egyptian torturers had gotten training from the FBI at Quantico. We learned that the State Department had authorized the theft of the DNA of the Secretary General of the United Nations, among others. And we learned that the Obama administration allowed Yemen's president to cover up a secret U.S. drone bombing campaign, said that they would take credit for the bombing that we were doing, the killing that we were doing. It's pretty amazing. You add it all up. It's quite amazing. So, Kathy in Etna, Wyoming. Hey, Kathy, thanks for watching. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, before I get to my point, did you hear about Halliburton being on 3 years probation for destroying documents regarding the BP oil spill?
Yes, and a $200,000 fine. And this is for killing 11 people, 11 men who died down there, destroying the lives of probably a million people, wiping out
environment.
God only knows how many other life forms, yeah.
Right.
$200,000 fine, 3 years probation.
Yeah. But I'm embarrassed about my call, but I just have to point this out regarding Eileen talking about her phone clicking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a serious activist and have been for several years now. About a year after I started my seriousness, my phone started, it's not a clicking, it's a pause in conversation, and the people on the other end of the line can hear it as well.
Hmm.
So I started making phone calls to my phone company. They told me to go to the sheriff's office. They would not say yes or no.
Hmm. Well, whether your phone is tapped, you mean?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheriff's office would not say yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
So my husband happened to be working at a job site, and one of the guys, it says he's a former CIA agent. I have no idea if that's true, but that's what he said. So my husband gave a phone call scenario, and see, my phone's doing it right now, if you can even hear it.
Mm-hmm.
It just, like, pauses and blanks out. But anyway, he gave the scenario to this supposedly former CIA agent, and he, like, looked at my husband after hearing the story, and he said, well, I can't confirm or deny. And then he chuckled. And he said, well, David, it sounds like your phone's being tapped.
Yeah.
So for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, it may well be. My point was that the old-fashioned, you know, the old spy movie stuff, you know, from the 60s and 70s and 80s of, you know, your phone being tapped because somebody had actually hooked something physically up to the phone. They don't need to do that anymore. They do this so far back down the line that, usually you would not hear anything. Now, it's possible that you've got, I mean, it's not impossible that you've got some local private detective or some local cop, some local law enforcement authority who is using an old-fashioned phone tap.
That's right.
Yeah, if you're talking on a wired landline, that would be far more likely. Actually,
and
because
we do.
Yeah, because a lot of the stuff that the NSA is doing is you know, they have a harder time tapping the copper. They have a whole lot easier time getting into the cell phones. So, or at least that's my understanding. So,
I just had to support Eileen because she might be right.
Yeah, no, I didn't tell her she was wrong.
Not really clicking.
Yeah, although when you beeped just a minute ago, I heard a tone. It sounded like you had touched a button on your phone and accidentally dialed a little bit. No?
I promise.
Okay. Well, then it may be whoever's tapping your phone just wanted to say, hey, Kathy. So it's entirely possible, Kathy. Thank you for the call, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls, my comments, and the news of the day. Welcome back, 10 minutes before the hour. We got a bunch of callers here. Let's try and get through them fairly quickly. Christopher in Midland, Texas. Quick point.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you? I had two quick questions. You were talking earlier about the SNAP program, the food SNAP program and all that. And I find it really peculiar that Republicans would spend so much time focusing on it when I think food stamps overall is less than 5% of the overall budget. And second of all, if you look at the states that have the most people on food stamps, it's mainly states like Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, deep red states. So what benefit did they get by focusing on cutting food to low-income people?
This is all political grandstanding, Christopher. It all has a racial subtext to it when it's used by white politicians, particularly Republican white politicians. And it is pandering to the basest, cruelest, worst instincts and constituents in the Republican Party. And I think it is shameful. It is, Paul Ryan and his friends should be ashamed of themselves. Christopher, thank you for the call. Gray in Nevada City, California. Hey, Gray.
Hey there, Tom. Have you heard about House Resolution 188? It would bring back the Civilian Conservation Corps?
No, I know about it. I didn't know that was the number, but yes.
Yeah, that's the House resolution.
It's not going to get out of committee, I guarantee it, unfortunately.
Well, maybe. But all this talk about unemployment, welfare. Well, if Republicans want people to get off welfare, they can bring back this program.
I agree. That's what Franklin Roosevelt said. He said the best welfare program is a job, and he put 12 million Americans to work. And guess what? It got us out of the Great Depression. Great. Thank you very much for the call. James in Vero Beach, Florida. Hey, James, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Hey, you're one of my best buds, honestly.
Thank you.
I want to mention Bradley Manning first. He took an oath, as they all do, okay? For him to have done nothing would have been violation of his oath. And number two, I want to mention Ted Cruz. Should he want to make a bid for presidency, he was not born in America.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
As George Romney was not.
Yes. Yes. So, given all the hysteria around Obama, there's a good chance they would be challenged for that. I think Cruz is just a pathetic grandstander. I think, though, that I'm not sure that you could call Rand Paul a serious candidate for president, but he's going to play that kind of spoiler role that his father played. And Chris Christie, of course, is getting pretty upset about it. James, thank you for the call. Dennis in Flint, Texas. Hey, Dennis.
Hi. I just got rid of this mouthful of food. Hi there.
Murphy's
Law. Actually, I thought it was by Amy Goodman that the testimony that Glenn Greenwald was going to give was via live video stream. I could be mistaken.
Oh, okay.
I remember she asking him.
I believe it if Amy Goodman said it. I didn't know if it was coming in by live video stream or if he was flying into town. I assumed if he was testifying before Congress, he was flying into town, but apparently I was wrong. Dennis, thanks for correcting me on that. The fact of the matter is, though, that he's not testifying at all because the president showed up at Congress today, which I don't think is any coincidence. Susan in Franklin, Arkansas. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the wonderful program.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say really quickly, as a mother of an Iraqi war veteran, that what Bradley Manning did was heroic. That's all I can say.
I agree.
And the other part of it is I know we don't have too much time, but I come up in the oil fields of northern Michigan, and I also do remember 1965, and I remember the Nixon try to renege. But what I wanted to say about the oil fields, going right down to the 50s all the way through 2000, there isn't a one of them that don't leak.
Yeah.
And some of them aren't just leaking the tar sands. Some of them are leaking poison gas.
Yep.
Some of them, the one in particular that I know real well is my family had something called the Redstone 80. Eight sisters, my grandparents, had this. Mm-hmm. And when you walk on that property today, it's totally polluted, 80th in the nation.
Wow.
So if anybody thinks there's anything out there that is salvageable once the oil field gets through with it, they're very wrong.
Yeah.
I even worked for Shell Pipeline.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Susan. And there's a great op-ed in the New York Times about this just the day before yesterday. I called a gangplank to something or other, but if you check it out, you'll track it down. Thank you, Susan, for the call. Marsha in Chicago. Hey, Marsha.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment back to the SNAP program.
Mm-hmm.
I live in the south suburbs of Chicago, and I've been going to farmers markets for years. And the farmer market that I go to a couple of years ago, started accepting the SNAP, and they had signs all over. And I am telling you, the people mobbed to that farmers market. The whole dynamic changed, and it was mostly African Americans piling in there. You could hardly get to some of the vegetable stands.
That's right.
I think that just proves that people are not choosing to eat poorly.
No, they're not. People live in what are called food deserts. We have massive food deserts in the United States. Typically places where people are poor, and it's not just African Americans, it's also rural white people. And you find these areas where basically, you know, the food that is available to them is through the equivalent of 7-Elevens, and it's Twinkies and junk food and fast food restaurants, and it's all high salt, high fat, and high poison. It's just not good for them at all. Marsha, thank you for the call. Robert in Gray Court, South Carolina. We got a minute to go. Robert, it's yours.
Yes, the law just recently arrested a couple for killing a man on the sexual predator list. They killed his wife as well and called her a casualty of war.
Oh, no.
You can find that on thestate.com.
Yeah. So this is the state of South Carolina?
Yes.
Yeah. And
County.
So is your point that publishing the sexual predator list is not a good thing or... What?
Well, the fella that did the dirty work, he had a big skinhead tattoo on his throat.
Okay. The skinheads are with us. No, I got it, Robert. Thank you very much. And just for skinhead alert, stormfront.org is the big neo-Nazi website out there, and they just posted Bill O'Reilly's race rant of a couple days ago. So he's in, you know, the appropriate company. You can go to stormfront.org and read all the Nazi stuff and watch Bill O'Reilly. Makes perfect sense. Chris Hayes did an absolutely marvelous job, by the way, of lampooning him last night. If you haven't seen it, go find it. I believe that rawstory.com is carrying it. And of course, MSNBC, you know, however you get there on the web, would be carrying it. So, anyhow, that said, we'll be back tomorrow with more of the news of the day, figure out what's going on over in Capitol Hill. Is Paul Ryan going to get his wish? Is Ted Cruz going to wake up and realize that President Obama actually isn't trying to shut down the government? Probably not. Anyhow, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.